If you have a local business, event, or initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is competitively priced to give you the highest quality ad at the best deals available. A staff member will guide you through the entire process and ensure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach at cfru.ca for more information.
Are you drawn to aggressive sounds? Are you subject to violent outbursts of rage? Do you have sudden urges to destroy everything in sight? If so, we have just the thing for you. Forever Deaf on 93.3 CFRU, Thursday nights at 10 after 10 following the BBC.
Hi, I'm Handel, and I volunteer at CFRU because I love working with the people here, and I also love the feeling of contributing something meaningful to the world.
CFRU is always looking for new volunteers. No experience is necessary, and all the training is free. If you would like to get involved, email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I love CFRU because it introduces me to all kinds of music I would otherwise not have heard. And there's a vending machine down the hall.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Thank you.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and I started out the show there with a very powerful piece of music there, a very meaningful piece of music. And the origin of that song, some of you may find surprising. It is actually a North Korean song that was performed by the North Korean State Orchestra, and it is a song of anti-colonial resistance for when the Korean people were struggling against the Empire of Japan, which had occupied terrorized and exploited their country. It's not really often remembered how the Japanese colonized, conquered the Korean Peninsula in 1910 and imposed a long and brutal occupation on that country that didn't end until 1945. And how much that impacted the identity of the Korean people to this day, particularly in North Korea, with regard to resistance to imperialism. The reason, of course, why I bring this up is because, of course, once again, we have a massive, you know, hullabaloo on the international scene concerning a nuclear test that the North Korean government has carried out in the past week. And once again, there are threats of sanctions, threats of repercussions, you know, threats of, you know, all kinds of propaganda saying that the DPRK of North Korea is insane, its leadership is insane, its people are oppressed, starving, all the usual kind of propaganda that we hear about that country, the very racist propaganda, in fact, that we hear, which is totally fabricated. It's basically without basis. It has no, you know, it's fabricated in things like gossip columns and like in the repertoire of Chinese comedians, which are then taken around the world and taken at face value because he said, you know, there was a Chinese comedian who once said that, you know, made a joke about, in his part of his stand-up routine, about Kim Jong-un feeding his uncle to dogs or something like that. That was taken as serious news by the West. By the Western media, of course, takes every opportunity it can to demonize those countries around the world that fight for self-determination, that seek to defend themselves, particularly against the American empire and the imposition of global capitalism on their countries. You know, those countries are routinely demonized. North Korea is perhaps the most demonized of them all. You know, especially when it dares to do things as test a nuclear weapon. And then we're, of course, supposed to be scared of this tiny country, which is half a world away, that supposedly is crazy and wants to nuke us all. When, of course, all it has is, like, less than a dozen nuclear warheads. Strictly for the purpose of self-defense. And basically cannot hurt us if they wanted to. You know, and yet, here's an empire with 700 military bases around the world, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. The United States, trying to convince us that the threat is this tiny country half a world away. That has a handful of nuclear weapons to defend itself. Isn't there something wrong with that picture? Now, before I go on, I want to relate something that happened to me, an experience which I had. When I was in Ottawa, just last year in December, some of you may know this place, and some of you might know what happened there, but there is an island in the Ottawa River. It's called Victoria Island, and it's basically in between two bridges, linking the Gatineau side of the river to the Ottawa side. And there is there's a old mill, very prominent landmark on that island. Now, there was an occupation of that island a few years ago, which didn't make national headlines, but it was certainly prominent, I think, in local news, of the Anishinaabe people occupying that island, trying to assert their rights to their traditional territories in that area, which is, you know, very, very sacred to them. And they occupied that site. You know, even if you go there now, there's like kind of this palisade, wooden palisade, behind which there were some trailers and things. That's where they actually were. That's where the occupation happened. And at that site of that occupation, there is a totem pole. It must have been, I think, carved by some solidarity groups in Western Canada. And there are some small stone structures of the kind that the Inuit traditionally make out of stone, and they put up. I was there. I was standing there by myself on that island. No one else was around in December as the sun was going down. This is an evening. And standing there on Victoria Island, you get an incredibly panoramic view of the Parliament buildings and all the and the massive, you know, bureaucratic government complexes on the Gatineau side of the river, and the Supreme Court building, and the Canada Library and all these kind of massive structures of the Canadian settler state all around you. And here on this tiny little island, on this tiny little piece of land, there are some signs of the first peoples of this land, you know, sign that they've claimed this area and they're not letting go of their traditional territory. But they're ringed on all sides by the, basically by the forces of colonialism. And it's a lonely struggle that they have up against that force, which has been seeking to crush them all this time. And that is the forces of imperialism. That's been seeking to crush them all this time and drive them down, drive them off their land, take their land, destroy any self-determination that they had. And basically, you almost erase them from existence. The situation with North Korea, while it's not the same, does have parallels to that. The United States would like nothing more than to suppress North Korea, erase it from existence, and turn that entire area into a puppet state that it can control, it can exploit. It can lay hands on the land, the labor, the resources. You know, it can get it. Multinational corporations can go in there freely. The IMF can go in there freely. The World Bank can go in there freely. You know, it's the free market in the free world. You know, it's just come on in, boys. It's all yours. Take everything you want, you know, and maybe just like give a few give some handouts to the puppet rulers who you put in place there, just like they do in South Korea. You know, the South Korean government, of course, is repressing labor unions and workers' strikes and, you know, and smashing that country's teachers' union and all manner of things like that, you know, basically to try to drive down labor costs and repress the working class. You know, those are the kind of people that the United States likes. Those are the kind of leaders the United States likes. And they would like to see a situation like that in North Korea as well. And they've sure as hell been pushing for that for many decades, just as they have in Cuba, and just as they have in many places in Syria, like in Syria or Iran or Iraq or what have you. You know, they've been pushing, you know, to get their people into power and to impose their system on these places. And that all has to be understood about when you look at why a country like North Korea would develop nuclear weapons, why it would test them, while it would basically say, you know, if you attack us, we will retaliate with deadly force. That sure as hell is not an unreasonable thing to say if you are in North Korea's shoes and you are surrounded by enemies, you're surrounded by a hostile military force which, you know, threatens to invade you every year, you know, deploys masses of troops on your border, conducts exercises every year, which is, you know, simulating an invasion of your country, which South Korea and the United States do every year. It happens every year, usually in March or April. And, you know, is it not unreasonable to try to find some sort of guarantee that you will not be attacked, you will not be flattened, you will not be crushed, you will not be destroyed, you will not cease to exist? Is it not reasonable to take action to ensure your own survival? You know, think about that. Like, really think about that. Really, the imperialist governments of the West have about as much right to criticize the DPRK's hydrogen bomb test as the Canadian government has the right to criticize the Anishinaabe occupation of Victoria Island in the Ottawa River. And that is none at all. They have no right to criticize it. The imperialists have no right to criticize those anti-imperialist states which take a stand and take steps to protect themselves. They have no right to criticize that whatsoever. And we need to keep this in mind. We cannot allow ourselves to fall for the propaganda. Now, I'm going to play an interview, which I've played before on this show, but I mean, I'm going to do it again just because it doesn't get old. I mean, it's still absolutely relevant. This is Brendan Campisi, of course, who was on the show last week. you know, in that case, he was talking about China and the Chinese revolutionary struggle. But a few years ago, he was also on the show. This is the first time he's on the show, actually, talking about Korea and how the Korean Revolution came about, how the divide between North and South Korea really came about, and the role that imperialism played in causing that divide, in causing the present situation, and in causing the Korean War, for that matter, and just really laying the understanding about really what happened back then, which is this understanding I think, you know, you need to have if you even want to begin to talk about that part of the world. So I'm going to put that on right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. This is Brendan Campisi talking about Gabriel Kolko's analysis of the revolution in Korea. So please stay tuned.
Okay, so we have Brendan Campisi here again to talk about the politics of war and the limits of power by Kolko. So another topic he talks about is the transition in Korea. So what does he say about that?
All right. So the very first mention of Korea in the politics of war, and the first point when Korea sort of gained any kind of attention in terms of global politics during this period, was in 1943, when at a conference of the great powers in Moscow, a very sort of vague and more or less perfunctory agreement was reached to take Korea into some kind of trusteeship after the war, after the Japanese had been defeated, and that it would be essentially run by one or all of the great powers. And the United States wanted that to last for as long as possible. They suggested 20 or 30 years. The Soviets didn't want to make any kind of firm commitment in terms of years, but what they were arguing was that it should be as brief as possible. The Soviets weren't pushing for, in terms of what was going to happen to former Axis colonies and even other European colonies, the Soviets at this point weren't pushing for immediate independence anywhere, mostly because they knew that the Western Allied countries were just not going to get behind that, so there was no possible agreement that could be made on that basis. But they were always advocating for as limited a period of sort of foreign rule as they could get the Americans and the British to agree to, basically. So the situation in Korea, of course, was that it was occupied by the Japanese, and it had been since 1910. And it had been subjected to very, very brutal colonial rule. The vast majority of Koreans under Japanese rule were kept in low-paying, dangerous industrial work or were peasants. And many of the Korean landlord class were dispossessed, and the land was taken over by Japanese landowners. And there was a great deal of industrial development in Japanese-ruled Korea, but it was all to export to Japan. It was all determined by the economic priorities of Japan. And Koreans were subjected to a great deal of national oppression as well. They were forbidden from writing or publishing in their own language. They had to take Japanese names, and they were basically taught in the educational system that Korean culture was inferior, and that you know, Japan was superior. So the situation of Koreans under the Japanese occupation was one of brutal economic exploitation and national oppression. So there was a very developed resistance movement in Japanese-occupied Korea. There were a number of sort of political tendencies in it, but mostly it was basically leftist. The Korean Communist Party had a very small presence on the ground in Korea, but they were an important force in the resistance nonetheless. And then there were also various Korean resistance groups in exile. There was a group led by Kim Il-sung that during the war was in the Soviet Union, but in the 1930s had been in northern China fighting the Japanese alongside the communists. There was another group of Korean communists in southern China that was also fighting alongside Mao, fighting the Japanese. And then there were right-wing nationalist exiles in Western countries, mostly in the United States, and their main leader was Syngman Rhee. And of course, Rhee and Kim Il-sung were eventually become the leading figures of post-war Korea in their respective Korean states. So in the war in Korea ends, or the Japanese occupation in Korea, I should say, ends in August 1945 when the Soviets defeat the Japanese. And at this point, the Korean people basically rise up. And Kalko describes Korea at this point as a very intensely politicized society. The resistance to Japan, again, had been a mass phenomenon, and there was this deep and broad underground organization among the Korean people. And as soon as the Japanese were gone, that became the government. Popular committees were organized in every city and town in Korea, and they started running the place, basically, everywhere where the Japanese military forces weren't still present. And they elected a national leader, or they elected sort of regional leaderships and national leaderships. And by late summer in 1945, they'd proclaimed the People's Republic of Korea. And there was a very clear political program that these popular committees were pushing for and that the Korean masses were demanding, and that involved nationalizing all foreign-owned industry, which was basically industry in Korea, and land reform and independence. Finally, independence for the country. So there's a very clear social and national program that the Korean people were demanding. And at this point, the Americans enter southern Korea, because the Soviets had agreed during the war that even if they were the ones who actually militarily liberated all of Korea, there would be two occupation zones, one in the north that they would control, and then an American occupation zone in the south. And, you know, it might seem strange that the Soviets would agree to this when there were no Americans, at a point when there were no American soldiers on the ground in Korea. But you have to remember that they were mostly concerned with sort of with the international diplomatic level of their relations with the United States, not, you know, the situation on the ground in one tiny country that was, you know, strategically not very significant for anybody at this point, wasn't, you know, a primary consideration. So they made that agreement, and the Americans started taking over their occupation zone in the south. But the thing is, before the Americans had any troops on the ground in Korea, they tried to exert their control through the Japanese military that were still there. They were giving orders to the Japanese in Korea, and they were giving them orders to suppress demonstrations and not to allow this sort of this energy and this politicization of the Korean people to release itself in any kind of substantial way. There was an order given that when the Americans showed up, when the American troops arrived in Korea, there were to be no demonstrations even to welcome them. But there was, not so much because people were happy to see the Americans, but because they were happy that their country was liberated from the Japanese. But there was this huge popular demonstration to welcome the American troops when they arrived. And the Americans ordered Japanese soldiers to fire on that demonstration, and a few people were killed. That, to me, I think, is a really sort of evocative moment of the post-war situation in Korea and the post-war situation in Asia. Because effectively, the Americans were willing to use, and the British and the French in their colonial possessions were willing to use the existing Japanese military forces that they'd just been fighting to crush nationalist movements and movements of the left. So that's the very, very beginning of the American occupation in South Korea. In North Korea, the Soviets found that the people had taken over, you know, the people had taken over the towns. They were running the towns and the cities, and they were running the factories, and you know, basically a popular self-government existed already, and they simply decided to recognize it. And they handed over as much political power as they could to the popular committees, even while they were still militarily in control of the northern area of the country. So it's at this point, August and September 1945, that the fortunes of North and South Korea start to diverge. Because in the north, what happened was that this program that the Korean people were overwhelmingly and very clearly demanding started to be carried out. There was nationalization of all the existing industry, and northern Korea actually had most of the industrial infrastructure of Korea under the Japanese, where South Korea had the majority, or southern Korea, I suppose, had the majority of the population and of the agricultural productivity. So that industrial base was taken into social ownership. And there was a huge, huge program of land redistribution. The landlords in northern Korea were given the option of staying as smallholding farmers, just like their former tenants, or of leaving. and the overwhelming majority of them went to South Korea. They simply, they couldn't conceive of being anything other than the ruling class. So essentially, in Northern Korea, 1945, a revolution is carried out by a popular and democratic government. That's the birth of North Korea, basically. And in South Korea, meanwhile, the situation is very, very different. Because while the masses in Southern Korea are pushing for this exact same program of demands of nationalization, of land reform, of democracy and independence for Korea, the American military government is in no way inclined to meet that program. Kalko makes the point that even compared to some of the other American occupation administrations in places like Germany or Japan, the Korean one was staffed overwhelmingly by extremely conservative military men, men with no democratic sensibility whatsoever, basically authoritarian sensibilities. And importantly, many of the American military leaders in Korea at this point saw war with the Soviet Union as imminent and felt that they were, logically, if that was going to happen, they were going to be on the front lines of the very, very shortly to arrive war with the Soviet Union. So there was the political character of the American military government in South Korea was bitterly anti-communist and very conservative. And that sort of prejudged what sort of political forces they were going to be working with in Korea. The Americans had a bit of a problem in Korea, which is that most of the conservative forces that they would be willing to work with had actually collaborated with the Japanese. And so it would, you know, it would look bad. It would be bad public relations, if nothing else, if suddenly the new government that they were sponsoring was full of Japanese collaborators. Thankfully, there were nationalist forces on the right, forces that had not collaborated with the Japanese, again, led by Syngman Rhee. So they very quickly created a very, very prominent role for Rhee and for his followers. But at the level of local governments and the police and the military that they started to create, it was full of Japanese collaborators. When they arrived, they'd found in some areas of Southern Korea, where the Japanese weren't still in control, a very similar situation to the ones the Soviets found, where the workers and peasants were simply running the towns and the villages, and land was being redistributed in a very orderly way, actually, and the industrial infrastructure was being run by the workers. And of course, in very sharp contrast to what the Soviets did, they made sure that all that property was taken back. If it was Japanese, they couldn't exactly give it back to its proper, or what they viewed as its proper owners. But if it was Korean, then they definitely tried to. And they actually took legal possession of a huge amount of land that had already been redistributed. And they took the land that had been under Japanese ownership, and they sold it, they just sold it on the open market with no kind of control whatsoever. So, as Kalko describes, most of it ends up in the hands of the existing landowning class or black marketeers and people who'd been able to get rich during the war off of the black market. There was also an enormous black market in Southern Korea at this time that American soldiers were participating in, and that was, again, similarly to China, causing massive inflation and pushing people into poverty. And the American military government imposed wage controls, but not any kind of price controls. So the consequence of that was just to push the workers and peasants in Southern Korea just deeper and deeper into poverty. And as a consequence, soon you have strikes and protests going on all over Southern Korea at a very, very high level. Hundreds of thousands of people are going on strike and protesting. There was an incident where a railroad strike turned into a general strike, which was then repressed by the Americans at the cost of dozens of strikers being shot dead. And then that led to mass protests from other areas of the workforce and from students that they had to suppress. The Americans and the Korean police that they were creating had to suppress with enormous brutality. And very quickly, the American military government in South Korea came to regard any expression of dissent as simply communist and Russian-backed and just not to be dealt with in any other way but repression and force. And in that context, they had elections in Southern Korea in the summer of 1946. And so these elections were an obvious fraud, basically. What they did was they held the elections in a number of levels so that as one official who actually participated in this described, so that undesirables could be weeded out. And they limited the vote to household heads or the heads of 10 households. So essentially they were limiting the vote to men with some kind of position of authority in their communities. And at this point, much of the left in southern Korea, which had a mass base and mass support, was already being suppressed. People were already being thrown in prison or hiding in the mountains from right-wing and American repression. So in that context, the election was an obvious victory for the right. And while this is going on, the other powers, the other great powers who wanted to have a say in Korea, they didn't want the Americans to be running the whole show, start complaining about this situation, especially the Soviets, who are concerned with the repression of the left in South Korea and the sort of empowerment of forces that they understand are very, very hostile to communism and to the Soviet Union in South Korea. And the Americans just try to fob them off, basically, and sort of convince them they don't really need to have any kind of say in what goes on in Korea. But they try to come to an agreement with the Soviets about holding elections in both of the zones. But the Soviets insist on excluding political forces that have rejected previous agreements on the subject of Korea made by the United States and the Soviet Union, and on rejecting the inclusion of sort of political forces that are known to be anti-Soviet, which would exclude the forces that the Americans were supporting already. So they couldn't really come to any kind of agreement on elections in both zones. And at this point, the Americans come up with the idea of using the United Nations to, this is in 1946-47 we're talking about now, to legitimize elections that they want to have in the southern zone in Korea anyway. So a UN commission is created to study the possibility of having an election in South Korea, having an election that would, at this point it was clear, lead to the creation of a new state. And on that commission are Canada, Australia, El Salvador, the Republic of China, so the Kuomintang, and the Philippines. So we have neocolonial American puppet states and a couple of Western countries that are very closely aligned to the United States, even if they're, you know, actually independent compared to the Philippines or El Salvador. But even this body very quickly realized that the situation in Korea is not one where any kind of free elections could be held, because when they go to South Korea, they're totally dependent on the military government and on the existing Korean administration that the Americans have set up to get around and to get any kind of information. They aren't able to visit, they discover they aren't able to visit many of the leaders of the left-wing parties to even talk to them because they're either in prison or in hiding. So this UN commission very quickly realizes that there's no possibility of having a free election in the conditions of repression that exists. It should be mentioned that it wasn't just the American military or the new Korean police that were repressing the left. The Americans had allowed right-wing parties to create militias, basically, including one that was explicitly and consciously modeled in the Hitler Youth. That was, I think, the one tied to Syngman Rhee's party, to terrorize the left. So in conditions of massive right-wing repression, the commission realizes they can't hold free elections. So the Canadian and Australian representatives say that they should just describe the situation as it is and say that they couldn't support holding elections. But the representatives from China and the Philippines and El Salvador, whose governments are, of course, much, much more dependent on the United States, say that they were given a task to legitimize these elections, and that's what they have to do. And eventually there's also a French representative, and eventually the French representative comes around to the position of the puppet states. And so the commission agrees. The Canadians and Australians, reluctantly but ultimately, they do agree to recommend that these elections be held and to stay in southern Korea and observe the elections when they are held. And the elections, when they're held, are essentially an even worse fraud than the elections that have been held earlier in 1946 for, I guess, at the more local level. Even there was a mass boycott of these elections. All the leftist parties were boycotting the elections. And even the nationalist right was boycotting these elections, because what everybody understood was that these elections were meant to lead to the creation of a separate state out of the American occupied zone of South Korea. And the nationalist right in Korea still wanted national unity. They didn't want to be limited. They didn't want Korea to be partitioned at this point. So even conservative forces that were nationalists and were opposed to partition boycotted these elections. And the left did. And in any case, the left was being suppressed and wouldn't have been able to campaign or you know, people wouldn't have been able to vote for the left even if the left had been running. So the elections are boycotted by the vast majority of people in South Korea. And Syngman Rhee's party, the one force on the right that's most closely tied to the Americans, wins an overwhelming victory. And Kalko describes Syngman Rhee at this point as a Korean Chiang Kai-shek, basically leading a clique that's only able to stay in power because of American support, and that doesn't even represent the majority of conservative forces in Korean society. And the elections are also held in a context of deepening repression. There are protests against the elections, and in the week leading up to the election, 300 people are killed in repression across Southern Korea. And the government in Pyongyang in the north, first of all, told people in the south to boycott these elections, but they also attempted to organize their own national elections. So there were elections held in the northern zone at this point, but they also attempted to organize an underground election in the south as part of a national Korean election. Of course, it's difficult to organize an election in clandestinity, but there were some votes that they were able to do it to some extent. But basically, after it had happened, everyone in South Korea who'd participated in the northern elections essentially was rounded up and imprisoned. So, I mean, that's also a good indicator of the situation. So, by 1948, you have two. The situation is that you have two Korean states, and in one of them, in the northern one, the program of demands that the Korean people basically rose up behind in 1945 was being carried out, and in the other, because the Americans had been able to control the situation, an extraordinarily repressive, at this point, basically a neo-colonial police state had been established. And that's the situation that, of course, leads up to the Korean War.
Yeah.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So I am Siegfried, and that was another song from North Korea that was called One Against 100. And so we listened to Brendan Campisi's interview, which he did in 2014 here on the show, when he was talking to Patrick O'Brien, who was covering for me on the show at that time because I was in China teaching English. And of course, that talked about the lead up to the Korean War, you know, and the kind of situation which led to the division of the Koreas. In basically in the South, you had this basically U.S. puppet state, police state, basically, that was set up and basically was repressing its own people, and you know, basically explicitly trying to stamp out the Korean Revolution and the gains that it had won in 1945. And I want to say something about the Korean War and the level of destruction which actually took place in the Korean War in North Korea, because it's something that is not widely known in the West, and yet it's something that definitely still has a massive impact on that part of the world. You know, and frames the understanding that the North Koreans have, like in terms of, you know, struggling against imperialism and the kind of forces that they're up against in the world. Because in the Korean War was between 1950 and 1953. In the first year of that war, on November 5th, 1950, General Douglas MacArthur of the U.S. military ordered the destruction of, quote, of every means of communication, every installation, factory, city, and village, end quote, in an area stretching from the Yalu River, which is the border of Korea and China, to the battle line. The first city to be leveled was Sinuiju, and napalm soon began to be employed during bombing raids against civilians. Over 2,300 gallons of napalm were dropped on Pyongyang in one raid alone in July 1952. Mass firebombing systematically wiped out one town after another, and U.S. planes also targeted power stations and irrigation dams that supported rice fields. As irrigation dams were destroyed, villages downstream were swept away in the resulting floods, inflicting enormous death and destruction. At various times during the war, the U.S. even considered the use of tactical nuclear weapons. Hungarian correspondent Tibor Murray witnessed the, quote, destruction and horrible things committed by the American forces. Everything which moved in North Korea was a military target. Peasants in the fields were often machine gunned by pilots, end quote, motivated by what seemed to him amusement. The majority of those killed were in the north, which had half the population of the south, although the DPRK does not have official figures. Possibly 12 to 15% of the population was killed in the war, a figure close to or surpassing the proportion of Soviet citizens killed in World War II. The act which inflicted the greatest loss of civilian life in the Korean War by far, one which the North Koreans have claimed ever since was America's greatest war crime, was the aerial bombardment of North Korean population centers. For the North Koreans, living in fear of B-29 attacks for nearly 3 years, including the possibility of atomic bombs, the American air war left a deep and lasting impression. The DPRK government never forgot the lesson of North Korea's vulnerability to American air attack, and for half a century after the armistice, can you continue to strengthen anti-aircraft defenses, build underground installations, and eventually develop nuclear weapons to ensure that North Korea would not find itself in such a position again. The long-term psychological effect of the war on the whole of North Korean society cannot be overestimated. The war against the United States, more than any other single factor, gave North Koreans a collective sense of anxiety and fear of outside threats that would continue long after the war's end. Now, I'm going to give a very brief summary of the kind of threats that the United States has made, threats of nuclear annihilation included, against North Korea in the decades leading up to now and continuing to this day. Because, of course, we hear all the time in the media that North Korea is the problem. North Korea is the crazy one. North Korea is the one who's threatening us. Meanwhile, in fact, what actually is going on is they are responding to threats of annihilation. You know, threats of their total destruction, which have been directed against them by the United States for decades, really since the Korean War itself. So, for example, the United States introduced nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula as early as 1950. During the Korean War, U.S. President Harry Truman announced that the use of nuclear weapons was under active consideration. U.S. Air Force bombers flew nuclear rehearsal runs over Pyongyang, you know, mock bombing runs with of nuclear weapons. And U.S. Commander General Douglas MacArthur planned to drop 30 to 50 atomic bombs across the northern neck of the Korean Peninsula to block Chinese intervention. In the late 1960s, nuclear-armed U.S. warplanes were maintained on 15-minute alert to strike the DPRK. In 1975, U.S. Defense Secretary James Schlesinger acknowledged for the first time that U.S. nuclear weapons were deployed in South Korea. Addressing DPR Koreans, he warned, quote, "I do not think it would be wise to test U.S. reactions," end quote. In February 1993, Lee Butler, head of the U.S. Strategic Command, announced that the United States was retargeting hydrogen bombs into the old Soviet Union at the DPRK and other targets. 1 month later, the DPRK withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. On July 22, 1993, U.S. President Bill Clinton said that if the DPRK developed and used nuclear weapons, quote, "we would quickly and overwhelmingly retaliate. It would mean the end of their country as we know it," end quote. In 1995, Colin Powell, who had served as the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, would later serve as the U.S. Secretary of State, warned DPR Koreans that the United States had the means to turn their country into, quote, "a charcoal briquette." As DPR Koreans put it, quote, "no nation in the world has been exposed to the nuclear threat so directly and for so long as the Koreans," end quote. Quote, "for over six decades in the early 1950s, the U.S. has turned South Korea into the biggest nuclear arsenal in the Far East, gravely threatening the DPRK through ceaseless maneuvers for nuclear war. It has worked hard to deprive the DPRK of its sovereignty and its right to exist and develop, thereby doing tremendous damage to its socialist economic construction and the improvement of the standard of people's living." But the U.S. aggression against the DPRK, against North Korea, isn't limited to incessant military threat. It's also economic. The breadth and depth of U.S. economic warfare against the DPRK can be summed up in two sentences. The DPRK is, quote, "the most sanctioned nation in the world." That's George W. Bush. Quote, "there are few sanctions left to apply." The New York Times. From the moment it imposed a total embargo on exports to the DPRK 3 days after the Korean War began in June 1950, the United States has maintained an uninterrupted program of economic, financial, and diplomatic sanctions against the DPRK. And these include limits on the exports of goods and services, prohibition on most foreign aid and agricultural sales, a ban on export-import banking funding, denial of favorable trade terms, prohibition of imports from the DPRK, blocking of any loan or funding through international financial institutions, limits on export licensing of food and medicine for export to the DPRK, a ban on government financing of food and medicine exports to the DPRK, prohibition on import and export transactions related to transportation, a ban on dual-use exports, that's civilian goods that can be adapted for military purposes. And we know how broad that can be defined, given the scope of the sanctions on Iraq, which resulted in the starvation and deaths of more than 1 million people. Prohibition on certain commercial banking transactions. And in recent years, U.S. sanctions have been complemented by, quote, efforts to freeze assets and cut off financial flows, end quote, by blocking banks that deal with DPR Korean enterprises from accessing the U.S. banking system. The effect is to make the DPRK a banking pariah that no bank in the world will touch. Former U.S. President George W. Bush was, quote, determined to squeeze North Korea with every financial sanction possible until its economy collapsed. So that's the kind of threat that the North Korea is actually facing on a day-to-day basis. But it's also important to understand the achievements of Korean socialism in the face of all that, in the face of all those threats, those threats of nuclear annihilation, threats of invasion, you know, the being flattened by American bombers during the Korean War, losing, you know, millions of people dead, and being under constant sanctions since then. The achievements of Korean socialism, of the DPRK, are very, very striking. I'm going to read from Caleb Maupin's, an article which he wrote for Workers' World Party in the United States. And it says, "The recent launch of a satellite into orbit is only the latest of many achievements of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The northern half of the Korean Peninsula is led by the Korean Workers' Party, a revolutionary communist organization. The banks, factories, and other commanding heights have been held in common and guided by a planned economy since 1948. The DPRK's socialist revolution has resulted in many achievements for the Korean people. Number one, building up industry. Before driving out the Japanese colonialists, North Korea had very little industrial production. After the revolution, Kim Il-sung, revolutionary leader of Korea, led the country in developing its infrastructure. From 1950 to 1953, the U.S. invaded the DPRK and tried to eradicate all that had been built with a massive bombing campaign. The Koreans resisted, and finally an armistice deal was signed. Over the next 3 years, in the three-year plan from 1954 to 1956, the industrial growth rate was at least 30%, even according to hostile U.S. sources." And he cites a country study, North Korea, in the U.S. Library of Congress. Between 1953 and 1956, the DPRK tripled its gross domestic product. Huge steel plants were erected. Electric power plants were also constructed. The country became industrialized at a pace that astounded